This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 26, 2005. The impacts of Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf South were many and varied, lesser known than the large number of refugees and the stories of rooftop rescues, is that the hurricane affected many public services that were already in danger, such as schools and hospitals. Chief among these is New Orleans Charity Hospital, part of a system of free medical care for the poor in Louisiana that was unique in the United States. FSRN brings you the end of charity. I'm Aura Bogado. Please stay with us. New Orleans Charity Hospital was a source of often intense pride for those who worked there, as well as those it served, who received a quality of care that was in many ways of the highest quality, despite having been the lowest priority for funding for many years. Charity Hospital was damaged by Katrina and is in danger of not being rebuilt, denying the entire population the ability to get medical care when they need it. FSRN's Christian Roseland brings us the story of charity and what it meant to the people who worked and received care there.
Coming into New Orleans from the west on the freeway, right after taking the overpass where Interstate 10 takes a sharp left before the Mississippi River Bridge, rising above the medium-sized office buildings is a stained concrete shell 18 stories high, which appears to be decades older than its peers. From the ground on Tulane Avenue, it is a looming edifice with many boarded-up windows in its two wide wings. But besides the telltale brown lines left by receding floodwater, there is little to indicate what took place here in the agonizing days after Hurricane Katrina, which are only the latest among the many difficult memories that the Avery C. Alexander Medical Center of Louisiana has held. On the streets of New Orleans, this building has another name: Charity. Big charity to the rest of Louisiana. The story of charity is many things: the story of an institution, the story of a building, the story of a way of practicing and thinking about medicine. But more than anything, the story of Charity Hospital is the story of the people for whom that building is the first and the last thing they see in this world, the place where life begins and ends.
Cheeky Black, my name is Angela Woods, aka Cheeky Black. I'm from the Night Walk, Lower Night Walk. Born on Charbonnet, born in Charity Hospital. 1975, my year, my claim to fame. You understand what I'm talking about?
Rapper Cheeky Black is one of the many thousands of New Orleanians born in Charity Hospital, whose ranks include politicians, professors, and doctors, as well as rap stars, nurses, and mothers, of which Black is all three. Cheeky Black trained at Charity Hospital School of Nursing, and like many here, she has an intimate relationship with the hospital. Charity was a level one trauma facility and took care of the worst injuries, mostly car crashes, but also the stabbings and gunshot wounds that are a fact of life in the sometime murder capital of the nation. It is taken for granted here that when you're in a life-threatening situation, Charity is where you want to go, and it is where Black brought an ex-boyfriend who had been shot.
A guy that I was dating had got shot in his arm, and he came to my house, you know what I'm saying? Then I drove him to Charity, and at that time, you know, it was his first shot wound, so he was like passing out and things like that. But once he got into the trauma area and into the hospital, they took care of him.
Everyone in New Orleans seems to have a story about Charity Hospital. Some are humorous, others painful, and some are not spoken of but become part of the collective memory of the building. Carolyn Bauman has lived in New Orleans her entire life, and generations of her family have gone to Charity for care. She tells the story of when her grandmother went there for surgery.
Back in 78, 79, somewhere thereabouts. And she felt a lump in her breast. And she got on the bus, packed a little bag, and got on the bus and went to Charity Hospital and told them she came in for them to cut her titty off. So they obliged her. That was before they started doing testing to see, you know, if the lump was malignant or whatever. So they cut it off, and she stayed there at Charity for about 4 days. And she kept telling them she had to come back home because she had a 17-room house at 3131 Pine Street, on Pine Street in Gertown. And so she kept saying she had to go back and take care of her house. And they said, oh, no, so you're too old. We have to keep you here to check you, you know, make sure that you can handle it and you all right. So the end of that week, she got tired talking to him about it, so she packed a little bundle again She went downstairs, got on the bus, and went back to her house. That's after she'd had that operation.
Bauman says the care that Charity provided was crucial for the largest population in the city.
Charity has really been a marvelous place for Black people, especially poor Black people, to go to. They've had the finest doctors there. And a lot of interns were really just testing on the patients there, but they still had very good doctors there, best doctors.
Charity Hospital as an institution began in the early 18th century, when a merchant seaman included a sizable sum of money in his will for medical care for the poor. While the methods of that care, the technology used, even the buildings themselves have changed dramatically over the centuries, that mission, caring for those in poverty, has not. Central to this mission was the passing, in 1926, of the open access law for Louisiana, guaranteeing medical care for those described as indigent. Until it was modified a few years ago, Louisiana was the only state in the nation with such a guarantee. The building on Tulane Avenue began in 1939 when Sister Stanislaus, one of the Sisters of Charity, an order of nuns who care for the sick and the poor, asked President Roosevelt for funds to build a new facility to replace the seriously outdated building that Charity was operating out of at the time. The massive facility, completed in 1941, along with University Hospital across the street, has been where hundreds of thousands in New Orleans without access to insurance have gone for medical care. Over the years, the care that Charity provided became legendary. Ben Dubois Blanc, medical director at Charity New Orleans, has worked there since 1977.
It's one of those places that was steeped in tradition. There's only a half dozen hospitals around the country that are recognizable by name. Charity, Bellevue, Cook County.
And for new doctors, walking into the halls of Charity could be a harrowing experience.
My name is Renee Morrissey. I work at Charity Hospital, where I've been for 4.5 years.
Renee Morrissey moved to New Orleans to train at Charity Hospital and recalls his first day at work.
It was a Sunday. It was actually only half a day. But I do remember being at home and sitting on my porch and my neighbors, whom I just recently met, pulling up and seeing me as they describe it now with a tub of melted ice cream half eaten between my knees sitting on a porch just staring off in the distance. And I was working in the accident room, which is the trauma bays where all the trauma patients come. I'd seen 5 penetrating traumas, which means people were shot or stabbed. And also, if I remember correctly, a woman who had been beaten in the head with a brick at a family dinner. And I just remember thinking to myself, what have I gotten myself into?
Charity had been in trouble for much of the past decade. The open access law that guaranteed medical care for the poor did not guarantee a source of funding for that care. Starting in the late 90s, Charity endured a series of budget cuts. Dubois Blanc remembers how Charity changed over the years that he has been there.
Every year I've ever worked there, the budget has been carved up and whittled down. We're always being asked to do more and more with less and less. And I think that's probably characteristic of healthcare in general, but we were already starting with less.
The results of these funding cuts were obvious to anyone who came to the hospital for care.
The largest healthcare expenditure is salaries. So what does that mean? It means you can hire fewer nurses. And if the Joint Commission sets the standard for what the nursing ratio is, that means you're going to have to close beds. If you can't afford to hire nurses, you have to close beds. You have to close beds, that means that the waits in the emergency room are longer. Fewer patients are able to receive those services. It's a frustrating experience for both patients and doctors for patients to have health care needs that can't be met.
Among those who Charity served is a man who would spend much of his next few years fighting for Charity in the legislature.
I'm Brad Ott, and Charity saved my life. I had a stroke, and I was rushed into Charity, and they reversed really about 90% of the damage of the stroke. This was in 2003, during the beginning of the very bad budget cuts. There was $60 million that was cut from Charity Hospital System, with $30 million from New Orleans. And so there was not a bed ready for me for 2 days. And so I was in the ER. No food. Actually, they had forgotten about us. They got too busy, You know, and then I did make it up to I made it to intensive care, which I was able to sleep finally.
After these experiences at Charity, Brad Ott went to work for the group Advocates for Louisiana Public Health Care, or ALF. But ALF lost many fights in a legislature that was becoming less and less interested in caring for the poor. The most striking change that Ott saw in those years was the gutting of the 1926 Open Access Law.
They repealed the Open Access Law that basically deemed that indigent people in Louisiana automatically got care. And so anybody who was uninsured and people who fall within 200% of the poverty line, without question, you just show your proof of income or your poverty, and that was it. And it was just a one-time thing. It wasn't. 2003, you were still given care in emergencies, but in order to access like doctors in advance and stuff at clinics, you had to go through a means testing. And that means testing was going on really right up till Katrina.
But these problems would be overshadowed by what happened in the sweltering heat the last days of August 2005.
I got there at about 5:30 on Sunday, which is the normal course of events for what we call a code gray activation, as you usually show up about 12 to 24 hours before the projected strike time of the hurricane.
Renee Morrissey was part of the team to be mobilized in the event of a citywide emergency. This time, it was not a drill.
It was actually really tense because of all the activations I've been on, only a few have actually had hurricanes, and those that did hit were, we were on the periphery. And this one was really promising in being the big one.
Renee Morrissey and another doctor, Michael Oudinet, were named chief residents for the event, meaning that they were responsible for the doctors and staff who would spend the next 5 days in extremely difficult conditions. However, there were some inside Charity who had been thinking about what would happen when a powerful hurricane hit, including Tim Butcher, director of emergency management at Charity, and his boss, Dr. Thomas.
Dr. Thomas sent a drill to everybody, telling them, clear your calendars, we're having a drill and you will participate. So he shared the concerns that Dr. Halton, our medical director, and I had about the possibilities and the consequences of a major hurricane flooding, and that helped us quite a bit because we had a lot of support from him in preparing in terms of resources and things that we needed to do before Katrina hit. In fact, most hospitals don't have a full-time emergency manager, and Dr. Thomas made sure that I had a full-time job devoted to that with Dr. Halton, the medical director, and I also had a secretary full-time, and that's pretty much unheard of in most hospitals.
Butcher says that in retrospect, Charity Hospital was better prepared for the circumstance than other hospitals and government agencies.
Dr. Thomas authorized bringing in more days' worth of food, more days' worth of water than some of the other hospitals were able to do. And the stark contrast is if you compare our preparedness with what didn't happen in the emergency preparedness office in the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana in the end.
With insufficient cooperation from the government, Butcher says that at times he had to find funding in unlikely places.
If it hadn't been for some federal grants we were able to obtain from the city of New Orleans through the MMRS terrorism program, we wouldn't have been able to have some of the backup generators and some of the ventilators and satellite phones and some of the things that really came in handy during the hurricane. In fact, those were obtained from a terrorism grant. We attempted to get a planning grant from FEMA for mitigation for hurricanes, and they turned us down. So we went to the federal government through the city and applied for a terrorism grant, and we told them that, Al-Qaeda might blow up the levees. And we actually were able to sell that idea, and we used that to get the money to buy the generators and buy the satellite phones and ventilators, because there wasn't any hurricane money, but there was plenty of terrorism money around, so we kind of tapped into that.
Doctors in Charity during the flood confirmed that the portable diesel generators and pressure-activated ventilators would prove essential to saving the lives of some of the several hundred patients who would spend the next 4 days trapped there. As everyone in New Orleans will remind you, the storm itself was only the beginning. The day after Katrina passed by, Morrissey witnessed a new and more dangerous situation developing.
That was Tuesday morning. I was woken, I don't know what time it was, maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, where the news that the hospital was flooding. We had to evacuate the entire first floor upstairs. I walked out onto our ramp, which is maybe 12 feet, 10 feet above the street level and saw that the water had reached a halfway mark and there was a significant sinkhole leading into the basement into which water was pouring. It was one of those things that you might see in cartoons that you think that if you get too close to it or that you'll just get sucked in. And I remember thinking that not that the hospital was going to flood, but that the hospital would crumble, just like watching waves hit your sandcastle.
Immediately, the staff responded to the flooding.
I don't really remember this time very well, but it's been told to me that it took us only an hour and a half to move the entire first floor of Charity upstairs.
During the next 4 days, over 1,000 patients, staff, and persons seeking shelter were trapped inside the building. Morrissey says these days blended together.
Time was marked more by events than by daybreak and nightfall, by days of the week. And I find it impossible to actually recollect any kind of cogent narrative.
In those days, those trapped inside Charity would survive without many of their basic needs being met. Morrissey recounts what a trying time those days were.
It's one of these situations where just when you think it can't get worse, it always does. First, you lose your primary power, then your secondary power, and then the hospital ground, it's overheating and then wiring and rewiring and blowing fuses and overpowering generators and finding patients that have, under previous circumstances, fairly routine medical problems all of a sudden assume dire circumstances because simple things like pharmacies aren't open or it's too late and the city has been evacuated.
Adding to the many difficulties faced by those trying to run Charity Hospital were distorted media accounts of what was going on in New Orleans. Medical director Ben de Bois Blanc was inside Charity and remembers hearing news on the radio that affected the decisions being made.
I think there were highs and lows in morale that were, to some extent, related to some of the misinformation being propagated over the airwaves about how dangerous New Orleans was. And we actually heard on the radio on, I believe it was Wednesday afternoon, as I was standing inside of the pharmacy on the sixth floor of Charity Hospital, just chit-chatting with one of the pharmacists, we actually heard a news report that the Charity Hospital pharmacy had been attacked by a gang of armed thugs who were stealing the narcotics. And we just sort of sat there and laughed through the whole thing. But that kind of misinformation, I think, made some fear for their lives. And it clearly changed how we approached the evacuation, because we had plans to go over and use the heliport at the Superdome to evacuate our patients. But with all of these news reports of lawlessness, we decided not to take that option.
Some, like Dr. Morrissey, simply chose to ignore outside accounts.
You know about the reports that were coming from the Superdome and the convention center about rapes and marauding gangs, and regardless of whether they are true or not, they were true to us. It took all I had, all we had, to maintain a status quo. But I knew from the evacuation that trying to anticipate things was as damaging as not anticipating them, and probably more so psychologically. So I stopped listening. It was a very good decision.
Regardless of what was going on outside, de Bois Blanc says that those inside Charity were taking matters into their own hands.
Well, we were invisible to the outside world. Our inability to communicate was the reason. We couldn't let the outside world know how desperately ill our patients were. In retrospect, we waited to be rescued. And one of the lessons I learned at Katrina, it's a wonderful lesson, I'm sure I'll carry it with me everywhere I go, is that the only one you can depend on is yourself. That as soon as we quit waiting to be rescued, two things happened. One, morale improved. We had a mission. We had a focus. And two, we actually started to accomplish something.
And despite all these difficulties, Morrissey said there were very few deaths in Charity.
I'm not sure, but my estimate would be about 6. None died in the emergency room, except for one who had been pushed on life support. Other than that, no one under my direct or supervisory care died. Because the people who work at Charity at all levels are there because they choose to be there, not because it's the best paid or the prettiest hospital or the most prestigious.
When patients finally began to be evacuated from Charity towards the end of the week, many thought the end was in sight. However, Morrissey says that the evacuation that proceeded was unreliable.
They would be loaded onto an airboat and then brought to a drop-off point where at one time there may have been a secondary evacuation vehicle, but that vehicle was gone now. Or the drop-off point where the secondary evacuation vehicle was showing up, I was turning down patients. So we would load patients and they would be brought back. Or the airboats would say, would come back with reports of gunfire and say they're not taking anyone else. Or that nightfall was coming and they would stop doing evacuations.
Under these circumstances, many of the Charity staff began to fear for the safety of their patients after they were evacuated and turned over to FEMA, who did not have medical personnel on hand to deal with them.
Very early on, the evacuation craft and personnel were requiring that each patient be accompanied by a medical staff member, which you can do the numbers and see that that doesn't really work out. I remember loading her and some patients on tabletops into the back of a cavernous 18-wheeler and sending them off into the water. As it turns out, this one particular truck drove to New Orleans Airport, where the staff and the patients were offloaded onto the tarmac, to discover that there was nothing there. That initially, they were told that they had to stay with their patients, who were now separated from all the resources which had kept them functioning and alive up to this point, no longer available to them. That was the first hit that the staff took, that it was not over for them. And they were now actually in a worse situation in some respects. And then being told by a FEMA official that the staff themselves were being secondarily evacuated, but yet no one was showing up to take care of their patients, and having staff refuse to leave, even though that's what we'd been waiting for 5-6 days now.
On Friday, a full evacuation of Charity commenced, and the last of the patients and staff were pulled out.
To my knowledge, Charity Hospital was the last hospital in New Orleans to be evacuated, because as in so many other cases, we're the last for everything, even though in many cases we're the first in everything. We receive attention and funds as leftovers and as emergency appropriations, even though we deliver care to the most important population.
That afternoon, Friday, September 3rd, Morrissey and two police officers closed the doors on Charity Hospital.
Well, we walked into the darkened hallway towards the ER entrance and left on the, and then walked out the door. I turned around and I saw the two police officers close the doors. There were maybe 8 or 10 people still left on the ramp and a couple of airboats sitting there yelling through the racket for us to get on the boats. Most of the people on the boats being actually armed guards, and got on the airboat. Two of the senior faculty were still on the ramp, and I remember yelling across the sound of the engine to one of them that I'd finally cleared the rack. And it was meant to be a joke, but it was very poignant, because we put patient file folders in a rack waiting to be seen, and it's always the question, how's the rack look? Did you clear the rack? And there's a psychological victory when you clear the rack, even though you know that the rack will soon fill up again. But I remember that's the last thing I said is, Dr. W, I cleared the rack.
Those doors have not reopened since. After the storm, an engineering consulting company, the Adams Group, declared Charity inoperable. Regional Hospital Coordinator Cynthia McThurn says that a main difficulty is repairing a wiring system from the early 1940s. And although plans existed before Katrina to build a new facility, the Louisiana legislature, which recently cut $400 million from the current year's budget in a special session, is unlikely to find the money for a new building. A temporary facility called Spirit of Charity currently operates inside New Orleans' sprawling convention center. The tent hospital has limited hours and is not a trauma facility. According to McThurn, two other area hospitals are currently carrying the vastly reduced trauma load, but neither is a level one facility. This means they lack the ability to do neurosurgery, orthopedic, and general surgery any hour of the day or night, the way that Charity did. The vast majority of people that Charity served are simply no longer in New Orleans. Ben de Bois Blanc points out the contradiction in not providing public services in a city with a displaced population that city officials claim they are working to bring back.
That's the catch-22. Without schools, without healthcare infrastructure, without social structure, who would want to come back? But do you build all that infrastructure with the idea that you're going to try to attract people back to the city? Because we're not talking about chump change. We're talking for a new hospital about $1 million per bed. So if you build a 500-600 bed hospital, you're talking $600-700 million.
De Bois Blanc says that the patients who went to charity are not seen as politically important and therefore can be easily ignored.
The people that charity hospitals served really didn't make up anybody's constituency. They tended not to vote in the same numbers that other people did, and they were disenfranchised. They fell between everybody's cracks.
Brad Ott feels that Katrina could be the end of a system of care for the poor that elected officials and hospital administrators do not see as a priority anymore.
It's potentially sealing the fate of Charity Hospital. There's always been forces that have wanted to take down Charity and not have Charity Hospital. Damn the patients, damn the people who normally go to it. And yet, you know, they, of course, are realizing that they also lose a part of their whole mission. Those private hospitals lost their trauma center, and by giving it the Charity Hospital originally, they saved themselves a lot of money. Now they have to reconceive that whole thing.
Ben de Bois Blanc is now working at Earl K. Long Medical Center in Baton Rouge. He says whatever form New Orleans takes now, it will not be the same without Charity. Cheeky Black lives in Houston, where she evacuated to. She says that if Charity is not rebuilt, it will be missed by the people who will not be treated the same at other facilities.
Right now, it's going to be real hard because those that didn't have insurance, you know what I'm saying, it's going to be hard for them. And for those that's in poverty, they're not going to have anywhere to go because too many doctors is not going to see them like that, you know what I'm saying? But I think it's going to be missed. It's really going to be missed.
As for Renee Morrissey, he still works in the charity system, now at the Chauvin Medical Center in the southern Louisiana town of Houma, which he commutes to from his house in New Orleans. He spends much of his free time volunteering at the Common Ground Clinic in Algiers and says he is trying to move on.
It's gone. I used to miss working in big charity and actually still avoid being with my colleagues, particularly those who were at charity during the storm. And it's been very effective to erase the longing. It's really become part of my memory and not my reality.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Rosland.
And now I'm taking a vacation on the third floor of Charity Hospital.
You've been listening to a Free Speech Radio News documentary, The End of Charity, by Christian Rosland. Thanks today to Basin Street Records and Kermit Ruffins and the Barbecue Slingers for their version of St. James Infirmary, and also thanks to Happy Talk Band for their song, Forget Me Not. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Special thanks today to Simba Russo, Jade Paget-Seekins, and Eric Klein. For a copy of this or any other FSRN documentary, you can check out our website at fsrn.org. We'll be back with our regular newscast tomorrow. I'm Aura Abogado. Thanks for listening.